stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today? Just after 1 p.m., Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Always wonderful being here. It was really, really great to meet some of you last week at the gathering. My comrade Greg Nicholson is here with me. Greg, how you doing?
I'm not sure. After last week, are we comrades, are we fighters, are we Democrats? What's the verdict?
I think Cadiz. I'm going with Cadiz. It's got a nice ring to it. Especially because I always kind of want to say Cadre.
I think it is Cadre, but we say Cadre.
My money said Cadre, so I'm sticking with him. But.
Why? What are you trying to say? That Musi is the authority on the French-derived words in English?
So I don't have a comeback for this, but I did find it interesting that Penny Sparrow has, a crowdfunding platform to pay off her situation.
Of course.
You have a history of going head to head with people who run fundraisers. Can we expect a Twitter run from you?
I was just looking at I got an email, a press release now from Sunco about that issue, but I hadn't heard about it before. But I don't think so.
Have you had a chance to read it? What does it say?
No, it's just Sunco, so the South African National Civics Organization, SLAM, sort of. They're very unhappy that Penny Sparrow, after I think it was 150,000 rand fine from the Equality Court last Friday for her comments, I think it was in January, her racist comments about black beachgoers in Durban.
Basically, them monkeys and messing up the whole beach.
I think so. Them just saying how disappointed they are that people are rallying around what a court has said is a racist.
All right. So, you know, if you've been dying for a way to contribute to the Penny Sparrow cause, check out for
her. Do not connect with us.
Do not connect with us and find the crowdfunding platform. Anyway, as I was saying, we had the gathering last week, which was a wonderful opportunity to really bring, sort of, people in power and people decision makers around the country from the leading parties to one place. So we had, very senior leaders and often the party leaders of the DA, the EFF, the ANC in one place, and also the mayoral candidates too. So we'll be talking about that for the next hour and just looking back at the highlights. What surprised us, what we were expecting, and also maybe some of the best insults. Simon Allison from our team was saying we need to do a ranking of the best insults, so we might jump into that.
I'm not sure. I'm actually quite an odd guest from the Daily Maverick for you to have on this show, because anyone who's checked the Daily Maverick website in the last day or two would notice that I was doing photography at the event. So
that's why, you know,
I can comment on the lighting, composition, whatnot.
I don't have a vocabulary of photography, so I'm gonna, I think
that's why
speed,
I'm here, I guess.
Shutter speed.
That's why I'm here.
But really, we want to hear from you. Please call us on 0861-555-189. Our producer Duncan is on the hotline, ready to hear from you. Also, tweet us on @DMShowZA. It was really great to meet some of, you know, our Twitter peoples in person.
Tweeps.
UUMF. Oomps. One of my followers. I'm told that's the thing. My little sister told me. Anyway. To jump right into it, first, we'd like to lead with playing a clip of one of the speeches from party leader of the EFF, Julius Malema. So we're going to play just 5-6 minutes and then sort of jump into, you know, our sort of takeaway from that. Give me a sec.
This is always interesting to watch Kingsley try and handle the soundboard.
This program took us away from the real program of elections, where we're speaking to our people about the importance of bringing about change.
Should I just keep some banter?
Speak to different constituency which will ordinarily and only get to see here, where people pay for chess to come and listen to politicians speak. So for me, it's a different constituency altogether, and then it's an opportunity to really hear from the other side. And I was asking Ranjani if you're going to be given an opportunity to ask questions, because I would want to sit in a meeting where one day you are given an opportunity to ask us questions and we respond to you, because sometimes we do not understand where you come from, because where I come from, our problems are not the same as you. But I'm happy that you had this event a few days before the commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the June 16. A June 16 where young people engage in a rejection of apartheid and white domination. And they said they don't want to be taught in Afrikaans. And the demand for them not to be taught in Afrikaans was not just a rejection of Afrikaans, but was a rejection of white dominance and a rejection of privilege that comes with being an Afrikaner. And we have seen the re-emergence of the same demand in the University of Pretoria, in the University of Free State, in many universities where
many young people have said, we are tired of Africans being given a privilege over other languages. And it is not something new, because the teaching of Africans is actually creating an impression amongst white people that they are the special ones, and therefore they are not people like all of us. And we think that the continuation of this struggle is very important, because it seeks to create equality in our society. We have a responsibility to ensure that we fight for an equal society. But we cannot be an equal society if others are given preference over us. And how are they given preference? Their language is preferred over our languages. And when we say Africans must fall, it doesn't mean Africans must not be spoken. It means Africans should not be given preference and should not be a language of privilege and power. It must be equal to all the languages in South Africa. That's what 1976 demanded. And all of a sudden you want to embrace 1976 and do not want to embrace the demand for the Africans to fall in the institutions of higher learning. That is being a hypocrite, because what the students are asking now is the same thing they asked before. The same thing with roads must fall, the same thing with the changing of street names and all that. What is this struggle about? The struggle is to do away with a white privilege and white dominance in our society. We will never do away with white privilege and dominance if we do not confront it, and if we do not conscientize society that naming places after people who presided over black genocide and promoted apartheid will actually make white people think they are more superior than us. And we don't want that. So I came here not to please anyone. I'm here to speak the truth, whether you like it or not. It's your own baby to feed, Malta Bella. I'm not in the business of going around to please people. I only tell the truth. Now, I represent a non-racial organization, but we do not fight for white people. Why? Why should we fight for them? What do you want? What do they want? When you say you are fighting for all in South Africa, black and white, what do white people want? Except to want to remain in a position of privilege. That's what they want. They want to remain in a position of privilege, and we are rejecting that. There is no white person who's going to remain in a position of privilege. We must all be equal. And in bringing the equality, we have to take deliberate decisions to empower the less privileged to be at the same level with those who are privileged. And that's what the EFF manifesto speaks about. Why should we build bicycle lanes? For what? White people demand bicycle lanes even when there is no cycling culture in South Africa, because they just want something to be done in their areas. Why? Because we are the ones who are paying the high taxes and rates. So something must be done here. You just want things to happen in your areas because you are paying, but there is a huge constituency of people without water and electricity. You must be ashamed that you want bicycle lanes. There are people without flushing toilets. That's what you are so principal came here to tell you before me. And he speaks everything nice. We are here to crush white dominance. We are here to create an equal society. And crushing of white dominance does not mean hatred of white people. It means the deliberate effort to liberate the black African majority, which is oppressed, and that is not division. Division is when you protect white privilege to the exclusion of black majority. And no one, not Musi, not Zweli, represent that agenda. None of them is committed to stand before you and tell you that we want to bring to black people to the same level with you.
All right, so that was just an excerpt from Julius Malema's speech at the gathering last week. And what I really found fascinating on this, Greg, was, I mean, right from the start, the first thing he says, a small dig at the audience, which was, this has taken us away from the business of campaigning, the business of meeting our people, and this is a place where people have paid for their seats. And that, you know, ordinarily wouldn't be a major talking point, but I think just that line was sort of putting a lot of middle-class people, and perhaps even a lot of white minority people, in their place in regards to what constitutes the majority of South Africans. And this is something Sisonke Msimang said a bit later during the temperature check panel, in just saying, let's acknowledge that when we are on the road speaking to everyday South Africans, doing the work, that's not you. That's what I took from that. And it's a sort of small dig, like you're paying for your seats. When there are community meetings, and he says a bit later that, and it's not in the clip, that when we have community meetings, a lot of you don't come. When we're engaging voters, a lot of you don't come. When we have rallies, a lot of middle class people don't go. A lot of white people don't go. And I think that's partially what I really took away and loved about Julius's sort of segment was reminding people their place when we are talking about the challenges of the country. So when we're talking about education, when we're talking about healthcare, when we're talking about food security, that it's almost like not talking about you. And not to forget that. When you get outraged, you're like, this country is going to the dogs and everything's terrible. It's almost that, I don't say belittling, but almost putting someone in your place and saying, remember who we are talking about. When we talk about majority South Africans, when we talk about everyday South Africans, remember who we're talking about. And I found that super interesting.
Yeah, I think at the beginning of his speech, he said he felt it important to be there because the audience had sort of quite a mix of, I think it was mostly middle or middle upper class, but also a little bit of a mix of different sort of representatives there. But I think he said that he felt it important to come and speak to sort of an audience that he may sometimes not necessarily address, although Julius Malema does get around to all sorts of places and all sorts of audiences. I don't think he's afraid.
He interviewed Oxford or something once, right?
So he gets around. Not even Oxford. Oxford seems to be one of the more normal ones, even. Okay. But yeah, he gets to some crazy places. But he's certainly not afraid to speak to anyone and give his views to sort of everybody. And I think the line he took in that little sort of segment that we played just then sort of reflects something that's been going on, you know, sort of in the last couple of years in the country, which is about, and I think is actually one of the sort of key themes of the gathering too, in sort of different iterations, about how people at the moment seem, or a lot of people in the country seem much more willing to confront this sort of past idea of reconciliation, and togetherness. And I think in Julius's clip where he says that the EFF is a non-racialist organization, but we do not fight for sort of the interests of white people. Yeah. I think that's one of the key sort of takeaway points, because that's quite separate from anything the ANC would say, and certainly far away from anything the Democratic Alliance might say. But I think it sort of fits into this sort of broader change in narrative and broader sort of movement going on of, look, we've had 20 years of democracy, but not enough has changed, both on the socioeconomic levels as well as, and those levels are represented still largely by race at the different classes, and in sort of societal interactions, the sort of stratified racial socioeconomic differences often manifest themselves in completely different racial interests and often racism.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that he brought up, and I think it's credit to the EFF for picking the metaphors that sort of the day would be fought on, and the whole bicycle lanes thing became a theme throughout the whole day, and that kept being referred to. So Julius's line was, you should be ashamed when you're demanding bicycle lanes in your neighborhood when people don't have flushing toilets.
And I think that was very clever of him. He took that line, I think, at the EFF manifesto launch at Orlando Stadium a few weeks back as well. And I think it's a very, very smart sort of position because when we do talk about people who don't have basic services, when a city's spending money on bicycle lanes, it seems ridiculous. Obviously, everybody, it's easy for everybody to understand, yeah, like, oh,
why it could be ridiculous.
Yeah, that sort of seems crazy, particularly because there isn't a huge cycling culture in Johannesburg. And at the same time, he also links it back to the point of sort of racial class differences. So it's not only about, oh, the city's wasting money on something we don't need. It's about you white people are continuing to demand things for yourself at the expense of the poor majority. And I think that sort of line, and I think we can talk a little bit more about the Bicycle Lanes issue when we talk about the mayoral debate for Johannesburg, because Mayor Parks Tau had we can jump into that now. Yeah. So I think Mayor Parks Tau, I think it's quite interesting in terms of where this policy of sort of bicycle lanes comes from and how the city is trying to sort of fits into the city's future envisioning of what Johannesburg should be, and trying to promote multiple modes of transport.
Yeah, between the BRT and the Gautrain, making local taxis safer, and then the bike lanes. Yeah.
And also to hopefully promote the reduction in use of cars, because to free up space on the roads and congestion, and also to with bicycle lanes. To hopefully, I think this is how the city sees it, as they try to sort of fill what they call the corridors of freedom and create nodes of sort of development, both business and residential, in areas that previously sort of existed between the white suburbs and black townships and the huge economic sort of business hubs, to have bicycles as one of the key modes of transport in between those sort of little areas, so, and fitting into sort of the vision of a future Johannesburg. And I was talking to someone from, I think it was the South African Cities Network yesterday, who criticized Julius's position on these bicycle issues, because he said he clearly doesn't understand the future of how cities must be, how we must work towards these things. And he also hasn't looked at, you know, because there's this thing, and all of us say it, sort of like, you've never seen anyone riding, you've never seen anyone using bicycles.
Suddenly
like
that's what everybody thinks, like, no one actually rides a bike.
So Parks Tau criticized that sort of stance, and supposedly studies have shown that some of the guys are riding, you know, they'll ride from Tembisa to the city center in Johannesburg and stuff, and people are using bicycles, but they need to be promoted more and assisted to use more. But still, it's such a great... It's sort of a difference of pointing out sort of the city and the ANC as this big big plan of what they're trying to do with the city to what the EFF and Julius is really trying to do, is just point out, no, things right now are wrong. We have to sort of fix the basics first. And whichever way you sort of look at it and whichever way they sort of go, it's still a great positioning point from the EFF side, because it really does resonate. And I think you won a lot of people over with that. With that sort of line.
That was a beautiful sort of, you know, sort of metaphor. And I think a lot of people sort of took a second to be like, wait, what are the things that I demand for locally? Just taking that second of saying, do I spend most of my time complaining about potholes? Or like, and not to say those things are not important, but it sort of makes you contextualize. What are the things I'm mostly complaining about? When my Wi-Fi is slow and there's a pothole outside my thing and so on. And how important is that to most people in the country? Am I really using my middle class sort of influence and power and money in the best interest of everybody else? And I thought that was just such a beautiful way to sort of put people in their place, so to speak. As you've said, not necessarily true. I mean, Parks Tau mentioned specific communities by name and listed them, places that have demanded sort of cycling infrastructure, that started their own sort of cycling clubs before the government came in. So it's,
which weren't white suburbs. I mean,
of course not. It wasn't Greenside. It was an actual place where people need them. And I think that's the beauty of, you know, I suppose that's politics, right? It's in the rhetoric and the sort of beautiful metaphors that capture stuff rather than the facts always. All right, next up, our friend Aloysius Musi Maimane. I'm just going to play quickly.
It's like Aloysius?
Oh, yeah, you thought he was about to walk in. All right, playing it now.
Out of 10 of them are run by the DA. If you took the same stat, out of 10 of them are run by the DA. If you took the same stat and you looked at the 10 West, I think it's fair for you to conclude which party is running that. It's quite an exceptional achievement when you consider the fact that we currently govern 26 out of more than the 200 municipalities in South Africa. When we look at unemployment as an example, the greatest challenge we face today, according to the latest quarterly labor force survey by Stats SA, the Western Cape's unemployment rate is 23%. That's the expended unemployment rate, which includes almost those who want to work but have given up looking. The national expanded unemployment rate is 36.6%. The differential is almost 11.3%. It proves which government, in fact, can deliver jobs. In Gauteng, right here, the DA-run municipality of Midval has an expanded unemployment rate of 18.8%. Whilst other Gauteng municipalities, this ranges from 24% to 35%. The message is clear. Where the DA governs, jobs are created. In fact, where the DA governs, people have the highest access to basic services and particularly the free portion of those services. The Stats SA Household Survey census released this week confirmed that when it found that over 98% of poor households in the Western Cape have access to a basket of free services. That is more than 50% better than the average in South Africa as a whole. And the strongest proof is that the DA is improving the lives of South Africans, particularly in poor communities. The reason why the DA is successful in delivering services, because it runs a clean and a more efficient operation. The DA does not tolerate corruption and waste. And this translates into direct benefits for communities. If you want a clear indication of this, in fact, of levels of corruption in government, then you looked at the unauthorized, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. In the ANC-run metros of Joburg, Tshwane, and Nelson Mandela Bay, this figure sits at 2.2 billion in 2014-2015. In the DA-run city of Cape Town, that figure sits at zero. 21 of the 26 DA-run municipalities received totally clean audits, unqualified audits without findings. Fellow South Africans, I think the facts speak for themselves. Poor South Africans are better off where the DA governs.
All right, as mentioned, that was DA party leader Musi Maimane. This is a short segment from a speech last Friday. For me, just listen to that. That was, for me, just sort of the DA sort of campaign machine at its finest, in the sense of the facts and figures, saying nine out of the 10 best governed municipalities in the country are run by the DA, saying that it's an independent report, talking about the unqualified audits they've received, talking about fruitless expenditure, and it's the facts. It's one of those things of if you're sitting there and you don't look up those the details yourself, you're like, this sounds pretty hard to argue with. You know, what he does leave out, and reading that governance report, it mentions clearly that a lot of the worst-run municipalities that are ANC-governed are in former Bantu stance, and saying that if you look at where they're starting from, there is nothing there. And not saying that, therefore, everything has an asterisk on it.
But there are more complications to these statistics once you sort of unpack them.
Absolutely. And if you look at them and you look at sort of some of those terrible term municipalities where something like water is a luxury, electricity is a luxury, and really, really basic things are not there, they're starting from just such a low base. But it's really hard to argue with without looking further when you're seeing that kind of confidence and seeing the track record, and that's always going to be that what the DA, at least for now, has on the EFF. They can point to statistics, they can point to the track record and saying, listen, ABCD, this is where we were and this is where it looks like now.
No, I think Maimane did quite well in terms of his performance at the gathering on Friday. He came with a prepared speech, as he usually does, and it was sort of pretty snazzy in his Obama-esque sort of tone. And I agree with you. When the DA guys list all of those statistics, you sort of think, like, particularly when we hear so often, especially the circles Kingsley, you and I sort of roll around in, such criticism of the Democratic Alliance's governance in Cape Town, particularly from the inequalities, both class and racially, and it's hard not to experience that when you're there yourself, because it is quite jarring. I personally think it's more, feels like more of a jarring experience than being in Johannesburg, when you see the differences in how different types of people live and their different sort of lived experiences. But then you hear these sort of statistics of Cape Town had something, you know, like, well, most DA run municipalities have like almost no or zero, wasteful, useless, and irregular expenditure. Yep. When they have a very high delivery rate of services, when they have I think it's the largest amount of poor people getting free services, these sort of things like that, it sort of makes you question. Also, I think the lowest unemployment rate.
Yeah, it's at low, under 20 if you take the narrow definition in Cape Town. Yeah.
And so sort of it makes you sit up, and I think what they're trying to put across is that they run governments well, they're efficient, and vote for them, and we're going to keep stability while making improving things as we go and trying to grow the economy of sort of the area. I think there's still a lot of people that sort of won't believe them and what they say. And I think essentially we need a lot of hard. I don't think we've had this yet in this sort of election campaign because the in the lead up to the local government election, it's been so dominated by national politics.
Yep.
You know, everything about Jacob Zuma, Julius Malema, Musi Maimane, and the economy largely, I think, as well. That's been a huge talking point in terms of the downgrades, the sort of low GDP prediction. And I think we need to actually get into some of these figures and look at, really sort of unpack and break down this sort of stuff. And I think you made a good point in terms of, so if you look at a former Bantustan, starting off a very low base, how, and perhaps whoever runs it,
yeah.
we can sort of look at some of these different municipalities and different governments, their track record over the 10 or so years.
Yeah.
And I think that would be a very good way to analyze these things because, you know, we're talking about different dynamics across the country here. And I think we need to start getting some real, and hopefully we'll start bringing this at Daily Maverick, some really hard analysis of the different experiences in different municipalities across the country and what works and what doesn't. But I think the other key thing that sort of that Musi Maimane tried to bring, and Herman Mashaba later too, about the DA sort of election pitch, is sort of not only do they say that where they run, they do it better.
Things work, yeah.
I think they're also really pushing that stability thing. And I think Musi Maimane's line was, I think that we're going to, well, change will come through the ballot and not the bullet.
That was his line, yeah.
And so he was really painting the ANC as this sort of corrupt, inefficient, ineffective party that has failed to address, you know, some of the things that really should have done better on in terms of the lack of education, huge unemployment rates, the dwindling economy. And then I think that on the other hand, it's painting the EFF. And I think Maimane spent a fair bit of time in his speech actually talking about the EFF, just saying that if they came into power, it would either be chaos and violence, or their sort of socialist-leaning policies would lead to a complete sort of breakdown of the economy.
He basically summed up their manifesto, saying the EFF manifesto says everything is free, and that's impossible, so it's going to be a disaster. And secondly, they will likely try and take power. And these are not his exact words, but he alluded to them trying to take power by the bullet over and over again.
Well, obviously, yeah. Sort of alluding to Julius Malema's...
Yeah, the Al Jazeera line?
Yeah, rhetoric that if need be, we'll take this government through the barrel of a gun.
Okay. So two quick things before we sort of move on. It's just sort of one is, I like that you mentioned the idea of sort of national politics clouding sort of some of the issues. And I think this came up in one of the panels. We won't have a chance to play that. Just this idea of political noise and how much time we spend on scandals, how much time we spend trying to decipher whose faction is on whose faction and who's fighting with who and whose allegiance with who. And not to say those things are not important, right? We'll talk about the Gupta family, those are things are important, and the NPA, those things are all important. But what do we lose when all our attention is on scandals and on factions and always at a national level and not on specific issues? So I think perhaps, I think that probably we as the media need to sort of find a way to keep an eye on national politics and national trends and those scandals and what's going on, but still not lose sight of the details. Mm. We haven't had a detailed conversation about employment across municipalities and how much of employment can actually be done by a municipality. Nobody asked that question.
I don't think we're even having a deep enough conversation of the role of municipalities across the country, or particularly the role of our big cities, because in terms of South Africa's future and development, they've got a huge role to play. And often,
all cities aren't created equal, right? Certain cities
that's have, right. Yeah. But in terms of the future of this country and how we experience livelihoods in this country, cities have an enormous role to play. And I think often we're just sort of talking about things at a broader national level, sometimes a provincial level, but often without getting really down into debating and talking about what that role is, what it should be, and how it can be optimized. But I think you're right. We do need to, as the media, look at finding a balance, because you can't ignore some of these big national issues, but finding a balance with sort of really hitting sort of, I guess, deeper sort of stuff on localized issues. But one note on sort of who I think focusing on the sort of this national issues often affects worse.
Yeah.
So obviously, I think without enough local knowledge, all sort of citizens, residents, and voters have a paucity of information. But I think the worst, it's really bad, I think, for the ANC, because the ANC's aim to tell their good story, and in many places they do have, you know, positive things to tell, and you can debate how much they should have done and perhaps what should have been achieved, but there is a sort of body of work and, you know, an experience that they have that can at least be packaged to really show that how this country has improved. And I don't think anyone can argue that the country has improved in, you know, a little bit over 20 years.
Yeah.
And sort of put that on display and show, here, this is what we've done, you know. Like, I think if you look at sort of how many people have access to water, sanitation, electricity, housing, the numbers are enormous. Yep. There's still a long way to go, but it's, you know, it's reasonably impressive. But because of all these scandals, it's hard to trust somebody saying, hey, there's a good story to tell, and this is what we've seen, when the national dialogue is so scandal prone.
I'd like to just dig into the mayoral stuff just very quickly. And Greg, I'd like to hear from you on this, because when Herman Mashaba, the sort of DA proposed for the mayor position, was first launched his campaign, you sat down with him. And in talking to you after and reading your article after, it really, I got the sense that he hadn't really started. That he found out, he opened his email and realized that he was going to be the guy, and he was trying to make a plan. And he had no details on policy. He had no details on strategy. And the argument then would have been, if we're going to be very forgiving citizens, was that he just started, give him a chance to figure it out. We saw him go up against Pakistan and Floyd Chivambo on Friday. And it didn't sound to me like a lot has changed.
That was shocking. When I did first sit down with him shortly after he announced his candidacy for mayor for Johannesburg for the Democratic Alliance, you know, he's got a reasonably high public profile. He's a reasonably charismatic guy. He's a talker, and he has his own sort of personal story that he can sell. But my impression at that time was that in terms of his politics, at that stage there wasn't much depth. There wasn't much behind that, and sort of my view was, let's see what happens.
I think he literally said, "I haven't had a chance to sit down with my team yet."
Mm-hmm. And then, you're right, his performance at the gathering on Friday was poor, to be kind.
I remember once, for maybe the third or fourth time, when he started a sentence with saying, "Let me tell you about my journey," or something of the sort.
He was even doing that. So for listeners who don't know, he was the founder of Black Like Me and other businesses, a big businessman and quite successful. But he kept on going back to his personal story, even when it was irrelevant, and he'd told it again. So it's sort of like, how are you going to build Johannesburg? Well, let me tell you about how I grew up. So what are we going to do about corruption? Well, let me tell you about how I built some businesses. Sort of, you know, you can do it once, but it gets fairly tiring.
I think the general trend is supposed to be that he worked hard, he got a job, he worked himself up the corporate ladder, and then he left and he started a business. And I suppose his campaign strategy my reading of it is, you know, if I can do it, you can do it too. And let's get sort of young people to go out there and make stuff happen. But I just think people weren't buying, and there was a lot of DA supporters in that room, and even didn't sound like they were buying.
Even the ones I spoke to after, most of them seemed to be quite impressed with Mayor Park's Tao. And I think that also really sort of showed up sort of Herman Mashaba's knowledge, because on the one hand, we have the executive mayor who has been around for a long time, has been in the Johannesburg administration for a long time, and really does know a lot about what's happening in the city.
More than anyone, if we're going to be honest.
He knows the facts, he knows the figures, and he can list them off. He's also, and he's not the most charismatic guy, not to say that he's boring, but he can, he sort of, he comes across as a technocrat, and that also builds trust. So, and then, so while he's able to sort of, he is able to sort of show those, that, that sort of good story, or at least explain what the city is doing
in extreme detail.
Then Herman Mashaba, I think his sort of lack of knowledge, or at least on the stage, that lack of knowledge, I'd hope to I'd hate to think that he hasn't learnt anything in these months since he announced his candidacy. But was, he was sort of sitting next to him, and I think the real moment of that debate came when Mashaba was complaining about the city's corruption. And saying, you know, I think it was like the corruption is holding back the economy, corruption in the city administration is restricting our development of jobs. And then Stephen Huertas, who interviewed him, said, okay, tell us one instance of corruption in the city. And I think he paused. Stephen said, tell us one. And then Mashaba paused again. And then he sort of, after a second or two, blurted out or muttered
JMPD,
the JMPD, which I think was quite a weak example, considering what pedestal he put the issue of corruption on, and perhaps some members of the DA now are asking themselves whether once again they've chosen a candidate with high profile over the right politics.
Black, right? Okay. Next up, I'm going to just play a short segment from who was, I'd say, headlining. Again, I'm not sure if that's, can you say headlining? I don't know. But sort of the last speaker to sort of take us home at the end of the bit, which is Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan. And we found out that the Gordhan pronunciation is not actually the right one, so it's a bit embarrassing for...
Or call us if you have any different suggestions.
Okay, so just playing this now.
Support. And it doesn't seem as if everybody is on the same page, because... You still have instances where people are living in hotels. We've had a case recently where it was reported that one of your cabinet colleagues is staying in a five-star hotel. You still have big amounts of money being spent on the cars of the first lady. So the kind of thing that you were saying in your first term already about cutting the fat and tightening belts, it's still not penetrating where it should be.
Yeah, but I think we must be careful not to use a couple of incidents and then generalize on that basis. I know the media loves that because that sells. But more generally, if you look at the period 2010 up to now, we've made huge progress. Take the area of procurement, where we now have a central procurement office. That sometimes frustrates people, because we're actually taking away opportunities for patronage. But look at the pluses. Take school book packs, for example. Last year, each pack cost some 460 rands, and you can multiply that by hundreds of thousands. And as a result of centralized procurement and negotiations between ourselves and the Basic Education Department, and vendors, that cost of 460 came down to about 130. All right, that's billions of rands that has been saved. The instance which actually gave rise to what we call transversal procurement being scaled up for many other areas was the ARVs, where provinces were doing their own thing, so to speak. Once we centralized that with the Department of Health, they now manage this. We probably save somewhere between 2 and 3.5 billion rands a year as a result of centralized procurement. Now, there's about 100 areas in which that kind of procurement is actually taking place. We are now negotiating travel deals, hotel deals, et cetera, et cetera. So the central procurement office has to save, I think it's 25 billion rands over the next 3 years through these sorts of measures. So there might be aberrations from time to time, but if you look at the trend, we're heading in the right direction, we're getting results. It might not please everyone, but by and large, the 1.3 million civil servants and all the politicians that are in the system are learning to live with it.
Yes, but Minister, in order for us to traverse these difficult times that you said that we are in, there needs to be strong messages from government frowning upon instances where there is wanton spending, where you know the messages you send out about belt tightening is infringed. But we don't get that kind of message from government that this is not tolerable.
No, money and any other issue is a constant struggle. So you're going to have many tugs of war, if you like, in each of these areas. The message is clear, and most of government has been repeating it. As I said, you will get aberrations from time to time. Most of you work in the private sector. Ask yourselves whether it is within the Daily Maverick or elsewhere, whether everything works perfectly, everyone sticks to the rules. From time to time, you're going to get people who go out and do their own thing. So try and understand that as a minority phenomenon. But if we're making progress in terms of the broad direction and the thrust of what we want to do, then we are satisfied that we're beginning to move in the right kind of direction. And the public must make as much noise as possible to hold us accountable, because that's what democracy is about. Hold us accountable where we make mistakes. I was going to say clap us, but that doesn't sound a bit impolite. But reprimand us for where we make mistakes as well. And ensure that the dynamism that should be working within a democratic system actually operates. And accountability and the fear of exposure, inverted commas, is what keeps these sorts of systems alive at the end of the day. If you as the public go to sleep and if the media goes to sleep, then others will have fun. Now that applies to corporate executives, by the way, or to governments.
All right. So as mentioned, that was Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, who's been on a bunch of headlines over the past sort of month, 6 weeks, 2 months, just about this issue about him being investigated and going all the way back to the December fiasco with who is the finance minister. I mean, for me, my impression was I left that sort of Q&A in the speech really feeling like that's what a public servant looks like. Was not afraid to delve into the details, monetary policy, fiscal policy, or the downgrades. Was not afraid to go into extreme detail about this is the situation and this is what we're working on. Was not afraid to contextualize stuff. So when Ranjani says, why are your ministers staying in hotels? He doesn't deny it. He says, yes, that happened. And he goes back to the trend. He goes back to the numbers. This is how we've cut spending over the past couple of years. We are on track on our cutting spending. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying that that is an anomaly and these are the facts. And then goes a step further and says, this is not unique to government. And he throws it back at the audience and says, hey, in your business, when you have a new HR policy, when you have a new policy, not everybody does what they're supposed to do. Most people do, not everybody. And you address the ones that don't. And it sort of leaves you feeling not antagonistic towards government, but saying, one, hey, these guys are working on stuff. Two, maybe I am overreacting about some of the things I read in the papers. And three, maybe I'm being too hard on government. In my life, when I say stuff, my kids don't always listen, or my employees don't always listen. Perhaps we can be softer on them. And for me, that was just such a great template of how government could respond better to allegations without being defensive, giving the facts, giving the trends, and then saying we're on it, keep holding us accountable.
I think that's the minister's line, right? Like he comes across as acknowledging the serious challenges that society and the country face, particularly from the economic point of view, which is his baby, yeah. But always being positive and looking forward to the future, to sort of a future where together, even under the current system, if people sort of come together in different sectors of society, do work together, particularly, government and the private sector, but as well as civil society and a host of others, things can be achieved. And this sort of sounds ridiculous to say, but it almost feels like he's telling us that there can be a positive future on the horizon if we work hard and work together. And I think when I say that now, I realize sort of how pessimistic I think many people are about the future of the country.
Yeah.
Look, it hasn't been an easy sort of 6-8 months, and even the last few years has been difficult. Like we're talking about before, the many scandals going on and the continued high unemployment rate and the dwindling economy. People are finding it hard to live, and he just sort of gave that, I think, a little bit of inspiration almost, but because it was wrapped in a dose of realism, people find it believable. I think the irony with this sort of thing is that often people almost see Pravin Gordhan, they put him up on this pedestal almost outside the rest of the ANC government. Yeah. But he's clearly an ANC, well, obviously an ANC minister. Yeah. Yet at the same time, and I think this is one of the other key themes of that interview Ranjini had with the minister, he is getting hounded, what's perceived to be, by factions of the ruling party.
I think this was exactly what I meant in terms of what happens when we just step beyond the factionalism, right? So when he was asked, what do you think? Do you have support? They're hounding you, they're investigating you. He just said, well, I have my job for now. Hopefully I'll have it next week. And this is what I'm doing. And I think that's the beauty of what happens when we just step beyond the factionalism.
The challenge is, I think, that stepping beyond the factionalism is rarely an option. I think it can be so pervasive. Obviously, I think one of the messages he was trying to put across is that there are many, many fantastic civil servants and politicians with the country's best interests at heart, and it may not be the overwhelming attributes that we can put down to our state apparatus, but I think at the same time it's extremely hard to ignore. But I think it's important to note as well that this so I wasn't in the crowd listening to this speech. I was sort of backstage waiting for the minister to take his photo as he was walking off and get these little moments. And I did notice when he came off stage, after sort of choking up while he was talking about some of these very difficult issues, it did seem like quite a moment for him. He was sort of patting a tissue on his eye. His family and a colleague came backstage and all sort of embraced each other and posed for photos. You could tell, I think he's under a lot of pressure, and it really seems like he's trying his best.
Unfortunately, Greg, that's all the time we have. We've probably got about 30 seconds to hear your favorite insult from the gathering. Do you have a contender that you remember? My favorite was definitely the SACP being called a spaza shop.
No, I'm not. I'm about, after listening to the minister, I'm all about our positive future and how we can come together to embrace a good economy.
Wow, that was terrible. I'm going to continue. Yeah. Download, share the podcast. We love
I'm not getting elected anytime soon.
See you next week.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.